hoping the part of the visual earth concept is coming on, and hopefully part of that, and then those can start the geo digital.
Okay, folks, we're getting started here. Okay, folks, we're going to get started in a couple minutes. Welcome to the SD Forum Virtual World SIG. My name is Bob Kendner. I'm the co-chair with Corey Bridges of Multiverse, and this is SD Forum's Virtual World SIG. SD Forum is, you know, software development forum. They host hundreds of great events every year, and at least several SIGs going on each week. A lot of great stuff to do if you're part of the SD Forum. Group. It's about $100 a year, and it's well worth it just for the SIGs alone, if not even for the special events. So definitely check it out. I believe there's probably some literature in the front of the lobby there. Corey is here, who will introduce Bruce. Before we do that, I want to tell you about what's happening also next month. Our presenter will be Forterra Systems, and Laura is here, who can just give us a quick preview of what you're in for next month. Laura, would you give them a little
talk? Sure. Next month we'll be talking about creating private, secure, virtual worlds. We will talk about how the virtual world can be developed, what kind of tools you use, specifically with our online interactive virtual environment platform. And we will give you some specific examples of things that we've developed in different market sectors with live demos and discussions of technology architecture.
Wow, excellent. Thanks so much, Laura. Here's Corey to introduce tonight's guest, Bruce Dahmer. Corey?
Hey. Is this on? Can the people... Hello? Can the little virtual people hear me?
They can hear you.
So, I actually just met Bruce in person today. We go back just exactly that far. But I've known of Bruce for a while, and I was very pleased to meet him today and find out from him what he's all about compared to what I thought he was all about, what I had read of him, from him, by him, about him. He's a fantastically interesting guy, great speaker, you're going to enjoy it. He's got a unique perspective on the virtual world industry. I'm a relative latecomer to the virtual world industry. I've been playing MMOs for a decade or so, and Multiverse is about 3 or 4 years old. But Bruce has seen several waves of boom and bust and boom and bust in the virtual world industry. He wrote a book called Avatars. It came out in 98. So he's got the vision and the hindsight and all of it together in one package. He's able to tell us where we've been, where we're probably going, how what we're going through now is similar to what we've seen before. And he's an energetic, dynamic guy, so give him all sorts of really tough questions. That's what I recommend. And don't take tonight for this week. And we're going to try to get create a synergy between an organization called Metaverse Meetup on the East Coast. It's kind of similar to us, but they meet in a bar instead of a law firm. So I think we know which is. I may not come back. I may stay in the bar. Anyway, thank you all for coming. And Bruce, take it away.
Thank you. Actually, I noticed if I'm standing here to offer exam that I won't get the sound.
It's very, very clear.
Sound. Are you sure? Should we move it?
Don't have to.
Oh, we don't have a very long cord for this.
It'll hear you just fine.
Or is somebody willing to hit the... Will you hit the space bar?
I can.
Or is somebody willing to hit the space bar?
Oh, no.
Here?
Certainly no one's willing. No problem with the space bar.
So we're mostly here as software developers, so...
PowerPoint is a tough one. Is there a way to lower these lights on here on the screen? Is there a little flip up and down thing? Hey. Is that better?
Hey, we're there. I've done my part.
So this is a presentation. It's called the Virtual World's Timeline, but it's really going to be a sort of a sweep through the phases of development of, I think I kept the can't leave.
Is it okay if I stand here?
Yeah, sure.
Probably do a better job. This is my avatar in an event called the Avatar Cyberpunk, which you'll see a bit later. But it's really the origins, evolution, and future of this medium. And about me, just real quickly, there's my first computer right there, PDP 1140. The purple switches, can't go wrong with that. Worked at Thomas Watson Research Center for a while. Developed some of the first graphical interfaces on PCs in the 80s that looked like a Mac, but they were derived from Xerox, the so-called Xerox Star workstation, old timers. There we are. Okay. USC graduate. I co-founded this company, which does most of your bills and premiums and whatnot today. Decided I was tired of the two-dimensional graphical metaphor, so I formed an organization called the Contact Consortium in 1995, which was formed to get ready for the birth of avatars, the virtual world on the net, which started happening that year. And we hosted a conference. I wrote a book called Avatars. You'll see a little more about it later. And we hosted online conferences and did the experimentation.
Ready to listen? Watch carefully.
Can you hear me? Yes, she can. Galen couldn't come, so she wants to hear me. You'll hear more about this organization, the Digital Space, I formed in 1995 to do commercial experimentation in the medium that was brand new at the moment. And the DigiBar Computer Museum, which is a museum in my barn on our property in Boulder Creek, which you're welcome to come to. It has 500 vintage computer systems. So it's all the computers that did run all the virtual worlds and the internet. And it's from Cray 1s to Altairs to prototype Macintoshes. Come and see it.
So are you trying to compete with the Computer History Museum?
We're kind of partners in crime, in a way. I'm like the garage, and we pull the things apart and get them booting. Virtual's Timeline is a current project, and this extraterrestrial project I'll tell you about later. If you want to know more about what I do, it's all at daver.com. It's all the crazy darn projects. And see it online at daver.com. So we're going to look at the origins in deep time virtual worlds and look at text worlds. Any people who are in MUDs? mud people? A couple of hands went up. Hey, there's a mud person. Whoever saw one. Anyone who wears an Australian hat is, you know, suspect. Graphical worlds when they first came. Internet connected worlds when they first came is really interesting. This event that we did for 8 years, which was really seminal, at least for us, and still valid today, when MMOs arrived, and the platforms that are emerging now, and the Timeline Project, and other research, and then we're going to go on to fashion and avatars. Actually, a huge factor in, say, Second Life's explosion is this. Garments, folks. I'll show you a little bit. Weird projects there. Avatar Space meets Outer Space. This is what my company, Digital Space, has been doing for 6 years for NASA. So it's virtual worlds for space exploration. And I think you'll like that. Exobiota is a project. And finally, we'll come back to the beginning to the end from the beginning. I'll show you something that'll make you laugh. So, virtual worlds, new medium born of the dawn of the space age and during the very birth of the computer. And I think of it as the sole new invention of a new medium for the 21st century. If you look at the 1880s, 70s, 90s, they had the telephone, you had, you know, film, you had telegraphy, all that stuff was coming out in the late 19th century, and it had a huge impact on us. But I think of virtual worlds as being the first giant 21st century innovation that happened in the late 21st century, it happened late 20th century. And how would you define it? It's probably a place that's described by words or projected through pictures, which creates a space in the imagination, real enough that you feel you're in it. So MUDs work too, folks. Things that aren't graphical are worlds, virtual worlds. So computers project words and pictures, therefore we find virtual worlds only on computers, right? But wait, was the digital computer the first place people experienced virtual worlds? Well, what about the caves of Lascaux? You can't go in here anymore because people's breath was damaging these paintings. But what archaeologists tell us is these environments were immersive virtual theaters. You had shamans dressed up. You had incredible lighting. I mean, they had incredibly well thought through lighting with tapers and whatnot to create shadows and effects in here. And a friend of mine built a scale model of this, went out and was studying the night sky at one point and said, wait a minute, this maps to the night sky. This is actually a star map. And so that's kind of an interesting projection. But these are non-trivial environments. These were immersive worlds. The entire culture of a community was passed on from generation to generation inside these environments. So in a way, and most of them were probably painted by savants. Autistics and savants made these. So the nerds of the time. So in a sense, I think of virtual worlds online as being our attempt to get back to the full immersion of these spaces. Because I guarantee you, if you were in a space like this, and a shaman was dressed up and telling you your history and acting out a story, you would be so totally bodily immersed, much more than you are in online worlds. So we're trying to get back to the peak experience of these environments. And of course, in the 17th century, they were using gadgets like this, the Laterna Magica, which had these painted glass plates, and it would project these images on the walls, and sometimes they would line them up so they would be projecting them two directions. An amazing technology for that time. People were just amazed. And of course, what that evolved into was, this is 50 feet of film jammed into this box with a viewer in it, and it rolls the film and you see a 2-minute movie. That's the Edison kinetoscope. And Edison was selling these as pieces of hardware, and the guy that developed the camera, the recording camera, came to Mr. Edison one day and said, I want to project this up on a screen and have people pay money and go into a theater and share it socially and have it non-encumbered, but they don't have to look in this box. And Edison blew up at him because he said, you're going to impact my hardware sales. In the 80s and early 90s, when VR, when the head-mounted displays was all the rage. There was a lot of parallels to this and VR because this was a solo experience that just cut out your vision. Women didn't want to look in these things. You know, women did not want to put on those HMDs. And when virtual worlds appeared on the internet, on screens, it was like it came to the movie theater. It's like cinema. So for instance, this was a kinetoscope parlor in the 1890s. Does it look familiar? Kind of like an electronic cafe or cyber cafe a little bit. And then projected film. This is the first film that was recorded by the Lumiere brothers, and it's actually a film of their workers leaving their factory. And let's roll the clock forward to another experience. Okay, does anybody know what this screen is?
Star Wars.
PDP-1. One of the first sort of kind of friendlier, more general purpose programmable machines called the PDP-1 had this great CRT on it. And one of the first things that was done on it, apart from polyphonic synthesized sound, was the creation of a game. And you probably won't be able to hear this a little bit, but this is us playing Space War on a real restored PDP-1 across the way at the Computer History Museum. And you're firing like crazy at each other. This is the sun, and it's sort of pulling you in with the gravity. And it was a rocking game. So somebody just swung around the sun. So that's Space War. So that really could be considered the first game on a digital computer where two people were represented by something graphical or a space in between 1962 61. This is actually like 3 weeks after I was born, this thing was running. And the amazing thing is when they restored the PDP-1, the memory was still intact because it's core, right? It was all there. So they could, and it matched the actual status of when it was shut down 30 years ago, the same memory. And they found programs in there. Can you believe that? Okay, 1974, we're rolling forward a little bit, a couple of other guys figured out the first the first computer that could do vector graphics that could be connected in a network. And this was a network that consisted of two of these computers. So it's not a very big network. It was called the IMLAC. And this was the model called the PDS-1, 1972. And one of the first things that was done was over here at NASA, at NASA Ames, they had a couple of these. They cost about $80,000-$90,000 a piece at the time. And they were in a Togo sandwich shop, which is still there by the theater. And they came up with the idea of a first-person shooter. They drew it on a Togo's menu, or something like that. So we want to maze. We know we can do hidden lines, on this vector machine, and we can represent somebody with a drawn-out vector name, and you'll run around this maze. And if someone comes around the corner and sees you, they can shoot you if you don't see them, and turn and see them within a few seconds. So here's this is Tom Uban, who actually. The DigiBarn has this annual 30th birthday project, and he restored one of these. They found the listing for the original maze, and we built a modern network of machines, and that's one of the guy's grandkids probably playing maze. And let's take a look at how this works. And Maze War, being the first-person shooter, actually established all of the things you'd expect in Doom or Quake or something like that. So here we are. Looks like HAL 9000, doesn't it? So now he's going down the hall. Real simple. And we actually built a connector with a PDP-10 emulator, and then we put all these machines on there so you could play with the original machine. There's the plan view of the game. Isn't that cool? And we're about to be shot here, I think, by a bot. There was a bot player in here. Watch us get shot. Yeah, the bot can see you, and you're out of there. Watch this. You have been shot by. Okay, so we were shot. And Maze just had everything. It had levels. It had instant messaging. It was played over the ARPANET. And in fact, at one point, there was this legend that a letter was sent out to all the ARPANET node operators saying, please restrict the playing of Maze to off hours because it's taking up half of the packets on the ARPANET. So this is about 75, 76. It was played on the Alto. This is the Xerox Alto version, which had an eyeball in place of a little thing. And Maze was copied over and over and over again. There were peer-to-peer versions of it. There were server versions of it. It was played on about 25 platforms. And it's kind of, I recovered all this history to bring it back because people had forgotten about this. There's nothing written about this anywhere. So we built a whole project to bring it back to life on the original platform, and there it is. But it turns out it's crashed an entire patent regime, too. A law firm for Sony called us up and said, you've destroyed all these, the prior art is so potent here that basically the idea of a shared graphical space with avatars and shooting and messaging and levels and building and world and spoofing and everything is now just trashed in the IP world because the prior art is so compelling. So anyway, but Maze wasn't too imaginative. It was very, very, stimulus response. It wasn't too imaginative. For imaginative worlds, we had to come up with this thing would come into the picture in the late 70s, text worlds. And if you ever played any of these and you think, oh, it's just silly, you're logging into a mud stood for a multi-user dungeon domain or dimension. And they came online in the late 70s. The first one that was ever played, still available, still can be played. And basically, of course, you connect, you select your name, and then there's a whole world described in text. And text is, you say, move into this room, the left, right, up, down keyboard strategy of moving around. And you could actually, in later months, you could build and affect the environment as you type. This is the Avatar MUD in 1979 on the Plato system. Anybody use Plato? It was one of the great pioneering online environments. And a little bit of a graphical representation of a world, but mainly a whole bunch of spaces, users in there, et cetera, et cetera. And so it was called Avatar MUD, not because that was the name of the users, but it's ironic that it was called the Avatar MUD. I guess it was just the name chose. I don't know the reason. And so commercial MUDs came out. There's a lot of detail here. The MUDs really created the idea of online role-playing, of course. Tiny MUDs allowed you to build in the world. Some of these are called MOOs, sort of object-oriented MUDs. And then the MUD phenomenon moved on to the BBS world. And then the BBS world, was killed off by the net. Or maybe it's still going on the net, probably in the mid-90s. But of course, what about affordable personal computers with graphics? The IMLAX or the Xerox Star would set you back tens of thousands of dollars, and you couldn't really buy it and run it in the home. But what about this guy, Commodore 64? They sold tens of millions of these things. Well, guess what? This is where we find graphical worlds coming on consumer platforms. Of course, Randy Farmer, Chip Morningstar, been in probably these meetings. Geniuses that they are convincing Lucasfilm to make an online environment as early as 1986 and do it on a Commodore 64, and yet they built an entire object-oriented architecture running in the bloody Commodore 64 to make this happen. It's a really amazing achievement these guys did. And from, you can go and see the Habitat papers online, it tells you the experiences that they had in Habitat really were mirrored again and again and again later. So here's this is like a Polaroid photo of a Habitat running on a C64. And this is just a sort of artist recreation of how Habitat looked. There were platforms derived from this later. Initially, there was chaos in the game because of you could do anything. So it was a very open first environment. And this is a very good strategy, I think, for them to figure out, don't make the environment restrictive in the beginning. Of course, everybody wanted 3D, and it was a dream. It was a dream of people who could afford $100,000 VR workstations until somebody said, named John Carnack, sitting in some weird place in Texas, I guess there was not a whole lot else to do, came up with this engine and created incredible fast graphics that would run without hardware on a 486. Good 486, 33 megahertz, 25 megahertz is all you needed for Doom. And, there's a lot of cheats in there, but it proved to people that, hey, I can do real-time 3D. And in a sense, VR had been kind of in this ethereal world over here. What Carnac's revolution created the world we're in today. and there isn't a whole lot of pollination between them. Because he brought it, he's like the brothers Lumiere, he brought the experience down to everybody. And then we jump forward, and boom, this is May 10th, 1995. A group at a company called Worlds Incorporated in San Francisco took one of these Carnac-like engines, I'm not even sure what they used, built a space station, and then connected it with a real simple UDP protocol and allowed people to wander around the space station, which is all pre-cache, so it was very high frame rate. The station was beautifully designed, so it was a nice experience. Doors slid open for you, had good sound, and you could chat. It's called World's Chat, so it really advertised what it did, chat in this world. And World's Chat, for me, was pretty phenomenal. And in this month, you know, we formed the contact consortium with anthropologists and science fiction writers because we thought virtual worlds are coming, but all we'll have to wait for years. And then next month, somebody emailed and said, it's here. You can walk around the space station and see other people and on the net through a modem connection. And so this is what the station kind of was laid out as, and you basically could chat and whisper and whatnot, and there were all these tricks on the station. That wasn't real gameplay, it was very social. There's some views, there's the avatar gallery, there was a mirror that kind of, you were a pig, you weren't yourself, you were a penguin in the mirror for some reason. And there were all these outside worlds that you could get to, and you could jump, you see in the upper right, people found a crack that caused a divide by zero with the engine and allowed them to get off the station and see this weird view of the station. So people were constantly jumping this crack. But this is World's Chat. Strangely enough, or maybe not so strangely, there was another one of these users, and it could be this one or that one, is Philip Rosedale. He's in May of 95, he's working at Real Networks, I guess, and he jumped into this and he goes, wow, this is incredible. And then his brain said, but maybe too early for a business. And my brain said, ooh, we got to get our organization going because it's going to be a whole phenomenon around this. So he and I were both just blown away by World's Chat. Then following World's Chat, there was this explosion of company-sponsored, sometimes university projects, and sometimes venture capital-sponsored environments of the mid-90s, the sort of Cambrian explosion. This is a still from my book that was sort of this universe of different platforms. And we did this bar scene in the book. It's it shows the different avatar technologies all in the one big party scene, kind of like from Star Wars or something. And one of the most amazing platforms, and I think to this day for me, was Alpha World. Worlds Incorporated had this kind of interesting corporate structure. They had a lot of venture capital, like $30, $40, $50 million, very corporate ideas that they were going to be the producing studio and make all this content for people, like for movies at launch and everything, and make a big fortune. And then on the side, there was this one guy named Ron Brickfitch who said, "That's all bullshit. That's all bullshit. The user should make the content, not you." And they said, "You know, we were not going to listen to you." But there was one believer in Ron who gave him enough money to start this little side project called Alpha World. And he sat at home. Well, there were 50 employees in San Francisco. He sat down in Carlsbad and he wrote this thing that could run under Windows 3.1 on a 486 with software renderware software mode and on a dial-up connection, and people could go around and they could build primitive objects, preemies in Second Life terms. And the whole thing just kind of exploded on him. He was surprised. The server sat right next to his bed, and he watched the server like getting, you know, going faster and faster and faster, realizing that users were finding it, telling their friends, and they were building, that the building was just exploding in the little green plane that he had. He had to keep expanding the world to allow people to build, because they could build without having to be 3D modelers. And so he actually donated his design notes to the DigiBarn a couple of years ago, and this is sort of his idea of having thin visibility and having, this is a real mess, but his idea of having visibility in sectors where you would load objects as people walk toward them. And this is actually I took these screenshots, it's the earliest view of Alpha World .30 release in the summer of 1995, and this is somebody landing. This is a default avatar called Psy. And that's some streets that somebody has built. This is a sort of gray plane, and then there's mountains you can never reach. And then looking from overhead, this is me and a bunch of other people talking. They're very, very simple interface. I've selected an object, it's called walk5.rwx. And then here is I'm trying to build something. And so I'm clicking there, and I'm trying to move this table around, and, you know, trying to figure out how this schoolhouse got built by somebody. It looks all very primitive, and it was. Somebody set up a newspaper and invented a newspaper object for a sort of newspaper called the New World Times. And here's sort of construction of the old original Alpha World starting in sort of late 95. That was how much it was so crowded. And actually goes out 100 times the width. This is this great big green plain in 2001. And that world's still online. You can still go through that content. Here's a wedding that's happening with people built the pieces and designed avatars a little bit to getting married. And we'll jump through to some of the other platforms that were notable at this time. Here's, I think this was probably done by Randy Farmer, but here's the descent of Avatar from this is from obviously from Habitat, and then this is Fujitsu's online environment in Japan, and then that became another environment called Worlds Away. And so Worlds Away's Dreamscape was a really phenomenal environment. Had vending machines. I'll show you, here's the dancing pup sisters of Worlds Away. Looks very much like Habitat, sort of grown up. And people say, what social life do I have? No, it's all in here. And again, outside point of view, you can see how you look. Gameplay with script. There was a scripting environment. And somebody's renting a flat. Rentals. So it's just like $11 or thereabouts. And there's the various heads, most of it designed by the company. And there's somebody in their apartment called the Turf, and that's their original default head. And often people could be talked out of their heads as newbies, and there would be incredible stigma if you're walking around with no head. You weren't just a newbie, you were a really stupid newbie. And they found the guy that had taken all these heads, there was an enormous pile of these things. So the palace is a very good example of a viral platform. Palace had this idea, there's this two-dimensional GIF image, and that people would, this is almost like a peer-to-peer system, people would connect to your world, and you could have 16 people, it was hosted on your computer. So it was your GIF image being served out, and then people, it's like your little website, and people would come in with the avatars, and there would be sound gestures and gifts given and whatever, and they were called worldlets, and anybody who had the palace had the ability just to add a room to it. Very, very simple architecture. It exploded. There were 5,000 or 6,000 simultaneous users at certain periods of the time in the palace. It was only just bested in the last two or three years. Jim Woodring, the famous cartoonist, did a lot of the design in some of the palaces. And it was funded by a number of companies, including Intel, Worldlet. But it proved that you could have a virally spreading user-hosted virtual world. It was simple, because you could scan in any picture you want and make a GIF file. You know, anyone could build a space. Travelers is one of my favorites. I'm like the guy from the Remington Shaver Company, because I liked this so much that I bought the company in 2001 when communities.com went down. I bought all the technology for this to keep it running. So Traveler was a phenomenal thing, and I kept it running online because it is unique. And you'll see why. MTV's deal with on there and things, they had done a deal with this platform in 96, I think. There were virtual DJs and everything. So MTV has always been attractive to virtual worlds. And this is what Traveler looks like. This is actually a Bill Gates avatar that Bill Gates actually ran at a Comdex and talked into it and lip synced Bill Gates. This is at a vigil. And this is Noel Paul Stuckey of Peter, Paul, and Mary, and he's a pretty frequent Traveler user, so the users built him this Tin Man avatar. He sings Puff the Magic Dragon and other songs he's written, and that's somebody playing a guitar. It's another avatar. The avatar's lip sync and their spatial voice, and let's just run this piece here.
Your first choice in the virtual world is what character will represent you. You can choose from a number of customizable avatars, with example of few small animals, clocks, and objects, and just various heads. You can also alter your voice as well as a facial expression.
Very happy.
Not only can you talk in your eyes for the first time, but you'll notice everyone's lip gloss also conducting well. Right now, online utopia Now, you might think it would be chaotic with that many people, but it's very much like being at a cocktail party where you hear the people next to you much better than those across the room.
So that just gives you a little bit of a CNET story. And interesting enough, Traveler, when I show in front of audiences today, because I've shown it for 10 years, people come and they say, it's the future. And I said, this is from 1996. And this is running RenderWare 1. It's DirectX 1.0, folks. It still runs under Vista. It's amazing. Thank you, Bill, for at least making that compatible. So moving on, VRML was a huge movement at this point, open standards effort, and a lot of energy put into it. A lot of people in this room are involved in that. One of the best VRML environments, of course, is Black Sun, named after the Black Sun in Snow Crash, the Black Sun Cafe, and it had all user build worlds and cyber cards, and it's still running. And it's a platform that's sort of worth looking at. This is a screenshot from Point World, the very first environment launched in 96. And this is a current community called Cybertown that's still running in Black Sun's technology today. And then you have a whole pile of other environments, various platforms, university research projects. This is Jim Woodring, the computer, again, working for Microsoft, and this is Comic Chat. So you type and the little cartoon panels are made, bing, 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 as you're typing. Really neat environment. Actually connected to IRC. Microsoft VChat. This is a very French environment. You couldn't speak English in there, or I think it kicked you out. Deuxième Monde, Second World. I tried to speak English. I think the bot kicked me out. This is a weird experiment called Interspace by a Japanese company. And this is VideoTar, so video of a person on Avatar needed ISDN to run. And this is a scene from Oz Virtual from Iceland, where all their worlds, surprisingly, were very dark and they looked like nightclubs and discos. So I want to show you one thing, sort of this period. There were hundreds of experiments and activities. There were learning experiments and all kinds of things, virtual office experiments, whatnot, that were going on. It's the same kind of things that are going on now with the modern platforms. But what we did as an organization, as a nonprofit, the Contact Consortium, that is, we said we have to do an annual conference. And we started initially with Earth at Avatars in 96 and Avatars 97 and 97. They were physical conferences. I had to raise about $100,000 every time to put them on. And San Francisco, where we did them, was getting more and more expensive. So in 98, we moved in-world. By the way, I coined the term in-world, I think. But in the beginnings of Alpha, where we were standing around and somebody was saying, how do I describe where we are? And I said, what do you mean? It's like, well, that we're not sitting in our chairs and we're somewhere else. I said, well, in a world, just say in-world, in-world. So people started saying that, and it's weird because when you have hyphenated words, it's usually at their beginnings of their adoptions, and when they lose the hyphen, they go into the dictionary. So the term in-world, so I put it in the glossary of the book. But we basically went in-world. We went from 500 attendees at each of these to 4,000 at this one. And we decided to do it across the platforms you just saw. Active Worlds, Black Sun, Palace, just everyone could be part of the annual Avatars events. Eventually, somebody said they were like the Burning Man of bits because people built the environments and then they went and partied in them. But we'll give you this is kind of a good snapshot into this world. And there's still things I'm part of the SLCC, the Second Life User, the Community Convention Planning and a Committee, and I'm constantly putting on the list, here's things we did at the Avatars events. Do the Avi Awards, do such and do this and do that. I'm trying to bring some of the knowledge we obtained from that event to them, to the new generation. So this is Earth Avatars held in San Francisco. Those were our speakers. And it was a phenomenal event. We had a Hollywood film director, that's Brett Leonard, who directed Lawnmower Man. There we are singing into Traveler Avatars. This is one of the winning Avatars in the Avi Awards. It's really just a tremendous event at the ANA Hotel, the L'Argent Hotel in San Francisco. This is the 1997 conference. I'm looking a little younger there. That's Jerry Brown, who was our keynote speaker. He's talking about voting in virtual worlds. And that if you're going to have an alternate society, we should have better rules, like you should be able to vote for candidates or vote against the candidates and not have them recall the election. So he cut the ribbon on a vote in an avatar world when people went through teleporters, yes, no, maybe, or no for Jerry, or something like that. So that's Spoon Man, runs the Anon Salon. This is Mitra, who designed the Vermal 97 standard and designed the World's Chat space station. That's Randy Farmer there. And so it was just that there's my beloved Galen over there in the mask. It's just a phenomenal time. But we realized that we had to put our money where our mouths are and we had to move the conference in world so we reached the people who were interested. And this is me at the farm in 98 on dial-up. So we had like 8 computers on different phone lines to be the master control for the conference and a house full of people. And this is what it looked like in the active world version of Avatars 98. And at the so-called Ground Zero, that's what they called the landing point, which nobody calls it that anymore. But there's our camera with us, and there's the Cyber Cafe in Santa Monica, the eCafe Santa Monica. And that's our landing spot. And this is a trade show booth. And the thing we did with this is we said, well, we're going to be conservative. We're going to build a Moscone Center. Because when you're doing your first ever cyber conference that's ever been done by anybody, you better be conservative, and you better take a model people understand. We said, a convention show floor. Just go with that. Don't be creative beyond that. So we did that, and it was kind of a good move, because people would land, and they would get oriented right away. They would say, oh, it's a trade show, and they would understand it. But they had to walk through these spaces, and they could, of course, teleport. But we actually, the second thing we did was we realized, and this is something that current worlds of today have to do, too, is that most people not only will not go into the worlds if they're going to buy a space and build a booth or whatever, they don't even want to build it in a Lego fashion. They want to fill in a web form, pick options, and put their trade show booth together. So Orlando has a big convention center called Orange County Convention Center. They came and filled the form in, put in their $400, and this booth was built. Just boom, it appeared in the spot that they chose on the show floor on the map. And the whole thing was automated, because we realized you just can't have people hand building these darn things. You're just never going to be able to manage it. I asked them, when the show opened, I came in here and I found somebody standing there, and I said, well, who are you? He says, well, we're OCC1. Can't you see I'm staff. We're ordered to be here. I said, well, why are you here? Well, it says, look at our sign. And I said, it says, it's like coming soon. 2 million real square feet of exhibition space. Like, our boss said, you guys better get there because we're putting up this whole new wing and we better find out if it's going to be empty or not, if this is where trade shows are going to be. They came back for 3 years. They always bought their booth. This is an avatar designer at Avatars 98 Zuzu's. And the art show, really important, people put their art up. You know, the gallery got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger as the box built the gallery out. And the interesting thing, that the speaker program, this is very much like how Burning Man is done. You know, in Burning Man, you just decide you're going to locate your camp here, or you're going to get into the book so that you're going to do a little talk in some weird dome while you're, you know, standing half naked, painted green, and that's your talk, and you put it in, and they put it in the book beautifully, anything you want. And we sort of thought, well, we'll do the same thing. We'll have a kind of general themes, and then anybody can come in onto the web and say, I want to put my session here. I'm 8 years old, and I'll say, well, I'll describe why virtual worlds suck or not. Well, you just bought yourself a session. And at the same time, you would have to go into another web form, and it would say, configure your speaker pod. And your speaker pod had all these options. You could have these boards and put pictures there, and you could have a bot that would throw people out if they were swearing at you. You want the heckle bot or not, because if you're going to swear as a speaker, you get thrown out. You have a webcam, and the bots would build your space. But this literally, people would be teleporting in, and the prior speaker would be finishing, and their space would vanish, and then the bots would put the new one up. And it was a little disconcerting, standing there, and someone else's whole world comes in. And this is, I don't know why it's doing that. This is the Avi Awards, which we instituted a kind of a Grammys, and this is the winner of 1998. His name is Summer, and she was a woman clothed only in butterflies. And there's the User's Choice Award and whatnot. And I'll just take a, just show you. We went in, most of this stuff, you couldn't frame grab this stuff very effectively in 1998. So unless we had a camera pointed at a screen, we lost the visual context of these spaces. So we restored this space. And we had some people go in here and just sort of walk around it last year. And the content looks really great because it's modern graphics cards. It's the same content that was there before. It hasn't changed a bit. There's the exhibitor directory, and there's all these silly businessmen, avatars, all doing the same gesture over and over, idling gesture, which is so silly. There's Boeing's booth. And some of the graphics are gone because they're not on the web anymore, because we just pointed it to the websites of Boeing companies. So this one's still there. And oh, there's Robbie the robot. So I had a bunch of people come in and reenact walking through the exhibit hall. And we're coming over to, I think this is the World Food Program of the United Nations is here. And they had a whole bunch more stuff here, but it's gone now. And there's a designer firm. So that was the exhibit hall. Avatars 99, we tried to, let's get creative. Let's have domes. Separate domes, Millennium Domes. It's going to be year 2000. And here's the scene from Avatars 99. And of course, we said, let's have, we don't want to have diagonal. We don't have diagonal. Everything's got to be in a funny angular thing. So there's our exhibit hall, and this is the speaker rooms. And people were very confused. They couldn't find their way around. So it wasn't a very good design, actually, for an exhibit. And so the big finale event this year was, let's unveil the giant number. We call this the Millennodometer. And so we had this sheet come over this number, and then it was pulled off, and there's this giant number 2000. It was glowing. Everybody floated up into the 2000. And it only shows the closest 50 people. There are about 450 people in this number. And then in 2000, we said, we really confused people last year. Let's come up with a space people can understand that isn't restricted to being a flat plane. So we said, we'll come up with the multi-toroidal space station. So this is the guide to Avatar's 2000 spaces. And they're all the same. And it worked pretty well. This is one of the toroids. And you would come in, you'd land in here, and you'd shoot yourself, warp yourself through here, and you'd walk around and see all the stuff, and then you would teleport yourself to the next torus. And this is the exhibitor's torus, the breakdown of the various exhibitors that were there. And this is the Avatar 2000 Abby Awards Taurus. And there's people standing around, and there's one of the grand prize winners. That was the popular vote winner. And then what we did for the grand finale this year was, and this is highly effective, we had bots, giant Pac-Man bots, these glowing globules come and eat the station. And then we turned gravity off. And they fell, they started falling, and then the bots put this vortex in. And everybody fell down through this vortex. And after being in an online event for 10 hours where you're really engaged and you're going to talks and you're heckling and you're running around and looking at your art and your friends are, you're very immersed. So when this happened, people are instant messaging us and saying, my face almost fell into the computer when you dropped the ground and you dropped us through this thing. And here are the people coming out, they're pouring out, all the conference attendees are pouring out of the bottom of the Taurus into sort of the party scene. And so you can see the graphics is gradually getting better, right? The years go by. Avatars 2000, so that was one of the winning avatars. And 2001, of course, we said, let's go more into the space theme, but let's actually try to steal something everyone knows culturally. What about 2001? An avatar cyberspace, obviously. We'll steal Kubrick's film. We'll basically had signs everywhere that said, covered under free speech, Liar avatars never appeared and never gave us cease and desists. So we built, this is a rotating station, we built all that. It's all done by volunteers, of course. What you had to do is you had to go on Dave Bowman's journey to Jupiter and to the Stargate. So you had to go here to the, here's the monolith, and you get your picture taken, and then all the radio noise comes, and then you go to your next location. So you go to the Discovery, and you're trying to get the pod bay doors open again, and so here we are at Pod Bay Doors. And right over Jupiter, these are the webcam world. We always had webcams from all over the world on some surface, and so this is all the webcams. And then this is like the hotel room, remember, that's around the black hole in the movie. This is the exhibits, art show, And the grand finale where people voted were these great monoliths floating at Jupiter. This pile of monoliths and pile of attendees and all these great effects that they did. And that was the grand finale there. And the last one we did was actually on the 111th birthday of J.R.R. Tolkien. This was the last Avatar Cyber Conference. This was about a week before the launch of Second Life in there, which is kind of ironic. We were plain out of steam. We've done this for so many years, and we were just going to have fun. And one of the things that was the theme of this conference was no warpers, no teleporters. You had to walk, like the Fellowship did, no cheating. So you had to literally walk the entire space to go to Mordor and to go to the different spaces. And it was just a journey. And so we did a bag end. And you want it for yourself. The ring that is in there. What is that, Tower Orthanc? And it was really quite a nice, whimsical world. And then there was the grand finale. Of course, it had to be fireworks. We didn't have a dragon, though. And the last event we did was I was transitioning to digital space and doing more work there, we did a beautiful piece of work called Drive on Mars for NASA, Jet Propulsion Lab, where you could drive a rover. It was very realistic of Mars terrain. So we did a Avamars, Avatars on Mars. And we worked with Kim Stanley Robinson as a science fiction writer. We did a contest to build worlds that would be from his books. Because science fiction's always in here, Science fiction writers gave us these worlds in our heads a long time before the technology did. So that's Green Mars. So then we jump. At the same time, of course, by the late 90s was EverQuest. You guys are all familiar with all this. Of course, before this, also long line before this, Meridian 59. Can't forget those. And so, these launched the MMO medium. And derivatives of MUDs, in a sense, in a real sense. And here we have RuneScape, and actually I have a version of RuneScape on the Apple II in the Digibarn, believe it or not. And Star Wars Galaxies, and World of Warcraft, now the great 10,000-pound Brontosaurus. And of course, all of this is familiar to you guys, but in a sense it's powered the rebirth of the virtual world medium. And here are some famous charts and graphs. And of course, Corey, who was with was saying how much he likes seeing these really slow curves from a business perspective, slow, steady, and not dropping curves of user adoption of these platforms. And of course, the overall adoption just keeps climbing, so it's a real medium. Now, we're looking at some of the current platforms. One of the things is people still use the term virtual reality, but I keep reminding them, no, virtual reality was immersive. It was an immersive experience, and we don't have that. There seems to be another generation of people trying to do like television glasses, and they like, we don't refer to the old stuff. And of course, the old stuff showed that 60% of people who sit in any kind of an immersion where it blocks your peripheral vision get nauseous or some kind of medical effect because it whacks your vestibular system. And all these new entrepreneurs are like, now we don't need to read the reports and the papers from before. We'll just go ahead and try it all over again. Hard to say. So virtual worlds less structured, of course. I sometimes use the term social virtual worlds versus gameplay world. I don't know if that's relevant. There, of course, is an overlap between the two genres. Sims Online, that didn't really go anywhere. We're waiting to see what happens with Will's next creation. Toontown, I never liked this, but I could understand why Disney would only allow you to pick certain phrases and all this idea that the corporation is liable for everything said by the users in its space, so they'll never go there. But it was, it's beautifully done visually. But of course, there, and I knew Jeffrey Ventrella, who did a lot of the sort of beautiful techniques. I love the emotional quality and the gestures were so beautifully done in this environment. And they're very innovative, and items for purchase. And here's Virtual Laguna Beach. Many of you have probably seen that. It did remind me of the OnLive Traveler worlds with MTV. The problem with Traveler is you can only have 16 people in one space. Virtual Laguna Beach more. I think that doing connecting with a TV series is such a fantastic thing to do with these worlds. It just creates an audience that's willing to go on and try. Here's some of Forterra's current projects. Is it a parent company in there, or is it a... It's a peer
company. It's a
sister company. A sister company. And, of course, there's a lot of stuff in the military space. We do a lot of contracting for NASA, so we understand that that's a good source of support. Here's Second Life at its launch. That's at the Global Kids launch. So you know all about Second Life, created by the residents. In a sense, Second Life has combined the object economy of Worlds Away that you saw with the building of Alpha World Active Worlds. And it's also done one thing really important. This is something that Philip Rosedale said to me, which is really interesting. He said, when we put up the map of Alpha World, he said, you know, that reminds me, somebody had told him, that reminds me of a coral reef. And the coral reef is alive at the edges, but it's dead in the middle. It's just structure. And that was a sort of a prescient image for him, that he didn't want to create a platform where the only where people were actively building was where there was people and interest and excitement, and the rest was ghost towns. And so they had came up with their whole metaphor, if you don't pay for your land, it goes away. You got to actively support the land, and I thought that was an incredible insight. And of course, the economy and the move toward open sourcing. And the future of Second Life, you know, their clients in open source, and maybe their server will be, and they're doing spatialized voice support. And I wonder, Steve DiPaolo, who is the designer of Traveler, you know, they decided to not have bodies. The Traveler, they're those heads. And they said, lose the bodies. We're primates. We're really focused on heads. If you all didn't have bodies and your heads were just floating in this room, we could actually still have a meaningful connection. You know, see, actually, the bodies do add. I mean, for Nordic people like me, the gestures are sort of a hard thing to connect to what I'm saying anyway. But so the interesting thing will be people who start out with a body metaphor and relatively small faces, how are they going to tie that to lip syncing? How are they going to make that big enough, for the primate brain to grok it? So when you turn around and you're trying to figure out who's talking, in Traveler, it's obvious. The head is turned towards you, you can see the lips moving, and you can hear the spatialized sound. It's totally obvious, totally natural. Whereas in Linden or any of the other body-centric ones, you're going to have some kind of a cartoon effect or something to figure out who's talking, so there'll be an abstraction in between because you just can't see the lip movement. We'll see how that's implemented. The coming metaverse. Well, of course, we know the term metaverse came from Snow Crash, Neal Stephenson's novels. And there's sort of an overriding vision by some of us that we can create a single metaverse that is a single standard. And I'm not sure if we're ever going to do that. Going back in history, if you look in the 1980s, you had document formats were everywhere. Well, we had this unique opportunity where HTML, which was a fairly limited, sparse document format, sort of conquered the world. With maybe PDF jammed in there, now AJAX jammed in there. But there was HTML, and there were hundreds of different document formats, and it did get forced into one thing. But I think that the conditions for creating a common 3D world may not be as readily available as we might think, because there's such a heavy, anyone who's developed, and as I have in my own company, developed a complete 3D engine with physics and all that, just the investment is so big. You get so committed to your experience, it's very hard to share that. It's very hard to say, well, we're all going to commit to one render or one scene graph. And everyone keeps reinvesting in these stovepipe worlds and building them over and over again. That's been the pattern for this medium since the 70s. You may dispute me on that, but I'm not sure that we're going to create a common metaverse unless Google buys some company and forces it on us, which might be good. Lots of platforms. There's Metaverse Roadmap. Several people in this room are going to New York to be part of a Virtual Worlds conference there with those folks and meet those folks. People talk about Web 3.0, and I would like again to a cautionary note. There are many people who would believe that, oh, well, I don't need to go to the Amazon page when I could zoom through a universe of books in 3D, and the books would come up to me, and I would do searches, and it would be so, oh, so cool. Well, it turns out that for 10 years, Xerox PARC did research on 3D interfaces, camshafts, and walls, and all that kinds of things. Beautiful work, if you ever can see it. None of it, they tested this, and none of it ever tested. People were confused. They got cognitively a little bit overloaded. A lot of people can't deal with 3D space. My wife, Galen, who's probably still listening here, gets sick as soon as she sees me running a 3D world. She's getting sick just standing there because her whole system of balance sort of ties into that space that she focuses on. 3D worlds are, for instance, another example is business. We built a lot of business spaces and tested them out. We tested them at Monsanto. We tested them at a company called Data Fusion. Where you'd have a virtual office and you'd have affordances, like the microphone brings in the sound and you have the rendering of the PowerPoint on the screen, et cetera, et cetera, and people are positioning themselves. But when you go into a real business environment that you all are in, and you just want to get onto the WebEx and see the PowerPoint and have a minimum of in between, do you really want to operate puppet theater and move yourself around just to be able to get in position to see someone's WebEx and maybe instant message? You don't want all that in-between junk. That's a cognitive overload that you're already overloaded with email and stuff. You don't want to have to deal with another layer that really adds very little to the experience. Certainly, that you're in a virtual conference room. I think it's a fallacy to think that people are trying to get data communicated and whatnot to add the overhead of 3D navigation and spatial and stuff like that to them. It's just too much to put on people. Multiverse, looking at, it just came a wonderful tour of Multiverse by Corey and Ron, who may have snuck out by now to get on that flight. So just had a whole tour of them and met the guy who brought us JavaScript, Bob, one of their founders, the guy who at Netscape looked at, and Netscape's a fascinating company because they start out with this idea that you make a bunch of tools, make them very open, and you build a whole bunch of indie developers on them. And that's, I think, what their philosophy at Multiverse is. Now I'm selling Multiverse. Mm-hmm. I'm not even getting a cup of coffee from them. But, hey, they are still here. They're, well, the idea, you know, I'm very heartened by these guys because they're kind of in it for the long term and they want to support weird little indie projects, and that's pretty much what I found in this medium that keeps me going, is weird little indie projects. And if you've got the guy who invented JavaScript on your team, that's pretty cool, because, you know, sure, it was kind of a hack thing, but it grew to support a giant industry, and maybe they can do the same thing for virtual worlds. So they're trying to do a universal client, etc., and indie developers. And I think that you're either going to be really in this market, there's sort of niches, there's your sort of university base, or you've got a set bunch of clients like the military and whatnot, and they can all come back to you year after year. My company, it's NASA. You know, they just keep feeding you. Or you've got your university base, and you have something that's mostly put together by volunteers. Or you're a huge expensive MMO project, and you have a growth curve like this and a crash curve, so you've got to bump your revenue, and then before you crash, you've got to dump your engine, go to a new engine, and grab the users between the platforms. And, you know, it's like feature films. But there's got to be something in between, and I think that's what these guys are aimed at, which is the people who want to do something more serious than the volunteer graduate student thing that only one person uses, or et cetera, et cetera. But they want to do a beefier thing that's a real thing that might be for research, it might be for a big experiment, it might be a cultural thing for a government, or whatever. There's got to be a pretty open platform that also has corporate support, so you don't sort of die and go away when the graduate student graduates. And I think that they're trying to find a good niche, and I think they'll probably do it. Anyway, more Multiverse stuff. How did this get in here? So they're coming out with something called Arden, which is a Shakespeare-inspired platform at a university. A couple more things, these 3D villages. I don't know a whole lot about this. I've just been sort of searching of what may be coming up this year. I think that this is for MySpace, right? This is being built for MySpace users. This Kineva?
They've got a separate network, but that's the notion. It's going to be a 3D virtual world that actually is connected to a real social network.
Okay, so real tie-in. Of course, Google, is it going to be a multi-user? Are we going to be able to see people walking around here and they have cell phones and we know where they are? You know, are we going to see them? Is it going to be Neil Stephenson's Metaverse Planet with all that SketchUp? So here's the sort of SketchUp ideas. You know, will it become multi-user? Does it make any sense for them to make it multi-user? Let's jump here for a second to kind of a pet project that I have, and it seems this falls on the sevens, at least 1997, Farmer and Morningstar, the official avatar handbook for Habitat. And look, Theodosius, a book for us, you know, so that's referring to somebody in world, maybe an oracle. And this is when my book came out, ironically, in 1997, so I thought, what would be a good thing to do in 2007? And I think what this movement or medium needs is context. It needs to understand that all this stuff came before, goes way the heck back, and that you are a part of it. And it's a place to put your own little history in, but to look back and find out the prior mistakes and successes and brilliances and ridiculous things that were done. Otherwise, you get adrift. Every time a new venture starts, there's nowhere to reference and find out what's been done on this before. Because our medium is uniquely ephemeral. And at least Brewster Kahle can archive all the web pages in the world every month. You know, because he stores all that kind of stuff, and it's kind of storable. Our medium's totally ephemeral. As soon as the client stops working, you're dead in the water. You've got maybe some screen grabs. You've forgotten all that history. And it was more only, the important history in our medium is who you met and the project you did or the life you led in the world. And it's totally ephemeral. It just disappears. So the concept I've had is to take a huge archive of stuff I have and hurl it into a wiki, but then have the wiki not like Wikipedia where it's very unstructured, but where it populates a timeline that you can scroll around. And I found this Simile project at MIT that has this Ajax, now Flash, an Ajax scrollable timeline where the bands move around. It's really incredibly cool. It's just XML nuggets. And so the wiki can populate this thing, and you could then scroll the timeline and pick things and get associated wiki material from it. So I'm looking for volunteers with noodles of time, graduate students who might need to do doctoral theses and need a huge archive of material, because we have that. And I've signed up about 700 people on a mailing list who already have archival materials from their prior experiences. And I've told everybody on that list, do not delete your files. You know, keep them. There will be a place for you to upload them at some point this year. The first university signed up is Umeå University in Sweden. The Humanities Lab has signed up and committed people and server resources to that. So that's the sort of ongoing. Anyway, sponsored by the nonprofit Contact Consortium, so they can get donations. And the scope will be from the 70s to the present. Mainly focused on social virtual worlds, but we might have the gameplay worlds in there. And you can see the call for participation at vwtimeline.org. Okay, there's tons of other research, and I'm probably missing things. Terra Nova is a superb place to read about from the writings from people in this medium. I'm doing a guest column there. I'm way behind. I've got two more columns by the end of the month. Play On, Daedalus Project. This chart, you've just seen some examples. Ralph Koster's done a fantastic job on a timeline. This is Farmer Morningstar's writing, and that's this project. And some readings on my book, even though it's not for sale anymore. I do have a few copies here to give away tonight for sitting through all this. So if you're serious about researching the history and really can use it, come up to me. I've just got a few boxes left. I figured this would be a good audience to bring them to. So other books are coming out. I figure a wiki is the only way to keep up with the medium anyway. I was going to do another book, but I was like, they'll be out of date by the time I've written the first chapter. And so there's this YouTubeification. I mean, you live in this wonderful world where YouTube becomes a place to put the machinima of the virtual world experience, and then that shoots over to your social network. You've got all this facility that didn't exist in the 90s mixing it up or mashing it up. Now, here's a real funny, great project that I hope you'll like. And I've always been a believer. Gail and I go to Burning Man. We get all dressed up. We go to thrift stores and find things. And we find that dressing up has got to be one of the most fun things. It's like wearable art. You just got to get into it, even if you're a nerd. Well, you do on the fly, but you can just dress up anytime. People used to. And so I've always been a believer that as soon as somebody or some technology mastered the art of garbing and garmenting in world, they would touch on a fundamental human need to be showy or sexy or stupid or whatever, and it would bring out a huge audience that didn't exist for avatars in the past. So we started to sponsor this in 1996 with the first conference. We had a costume ball, Halloween, come as your favorite avatar. 1997, we did the same thing in the big Anand Salon space in the San Francisco, and then we moved it in-world with these Abby Awards, and people would come with their favorite avatars. They would, anybody at the prize ceremony could wear the runners-up, switch to them, and the Abby Awards, this went on for about 8 years. And then in 2003, I said, we got to move this closer to the fashion business. So we had a friend at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City, which is in the Garment District. It's a school that occupies a couple of city blocks of New York. It's amazing. It's stuck in there. And this professor basically said, well, we're going to do this thing. We're going to bring students. This is the students that participated from her side. That's Professor Daria de Roche. And what they do in their third or fourth year at FIT, they get to make a garment in their lab. And then what we did with them is we paired them off with the students at Simon Fraser University in Canada with Steve DePaul, the designer of Traveler, and his students would do the avatars version of them from their fashion drawings, not from the photographs, so that you'd see how the fashion drawings are a little, people are very wild and extended in their fashion drawings. And the garment's a little bit, well, this is pretty wild and extended, this is Melissa here. And so then the avatars would be put into a world in the catwalk and be shown to the press in New York and the event in March of 2003. This is Leon, who took a Brooks Brothers suit and cut it up and made it into dreadlocks. This is quite a statement. He's Leon Gurevich. He's becoming a well-known fashion designer now. But this is his avatar, and this is his photograph, and this is him standing there. And that was an incredible event, and we were covered in Women's Wear Daily, which had never covered virtual worlds before. And now, of course, you'll see in online avatar space, that's a huge thing. So I then said, okay, coming out, what about if you have a passion for avatars and a fascination for garment design, what would you do with, say, your presence in world as an avatar is one version of your presence, but more people now, more kids are mobile computing. You know, they're going to have the new iPhones and everything, but they carry their computing on their bodies. If you go to Asia, they don't have PCs at home. It's all mobile. It's all GPS and senses their body and tells their friends where they are. So they are becoming their avatars. They're walking through the city streets and they are their avatars. So in a sense, it all then comes down, the whole thing comes down to, you know, a garment like this, you put your cell phone down here. How do you house this stuff? How do you connect it? And it's a real challenge for the apparel business, because the apparel business lives in the 18th century, where everything's hand done by patches of cloth. It's really out of date. And couture, forget about that. Sports and active wear, they understand this. They understand technology and computers, but couture doesn't. It's all a lost cause. So how do you house all that gear? And I'll take you back. Who read Snow Crash? Stevens and Hooker. The character, the young girl who had the hovering skateboard. YT, right? YT could hover her skateboard into the Westwood building of the CIA, wherever it was, and her body was covered with all these wares. There was like a hypersonic pulse, and there was her communication, whatever. She could take out the entire federal government just to go get a file. She was so powerful, her wares. And I always thought, what would YT wear? She wouldn't wear what Steve Mann wears at MIT, which looks like the Borg. She would wear something incredibly cool. And it turns out in 2002, MIT's fashion people came down and did a show for the FIT, mostly women professors at FIT, and horrified them so much about cyber garment, you know, technology, that they never wanted to see another bit of it. So I took this as a challenge, and I said, what would such a garment look like? A garment that you could have all your wares on. How would it house your wares? What genre would you derive it from? Well, it just so happens, in my office, I've got a framed picture of this guy. He's one of my ancestors. His name was John Harmon. and he was an admiral in Queen Elizabeth I's fleet, and he was, of course, a dandy, and he was shot through the heart. He's about 5'1", whatever, but he looks more like my brother, actually. But he was killed, and he was known for a very flashy garb and for rushing around parties at London. I guess he probably died about 39. Probably a good thing. But he had this cool jacket, and in fact, if you go to the Greenwich Maritime Museum, which is a wonderful place in London, this is a very enormous portrait there. It's considered the finest maritime portrait in the world, or ever painted, at least by then. And I thought, hey, that's cool. And here he's got gear all over there. He's got swords there, and God knows he's probably got daggers and all kinds of things, and you know, probably an early cell phone under there somewhere. So I went to it. I took a sewing class. I said, I'm going to learn how to make these garments. This is my sewing teacher in our bus. We have a double-decker bus on our farm that is a sewing workshop. So there I got myself a Bernina 1008, which is a sewing machine from Switzerland that will not break. And piece by piece, I put the thing together from a McCall's pattern. And it came out pretty good. The first thing I ever made. Galen likes it. So time to design the cyber version. So that took about a year to figure that out. So I woke up one day and I said, I know what this garment, I was like, how on earth do you design a garment like this? And I had this vision of the Altair 8800 computer in my head. And anybody work on S100 machines? Well, the original homebrew computer was this open source design, which was a bus. And you threw cards in it. You could throw your Z80 card, your 8080 card, your memory card. It was an open architecture before the PC, before the Apple II. And it created the idea of the PC as being an open thing. But the key thing was the bus. If there was a bus there, you could throw any card you want, create a video monitor on it, fine. You know, you want to have a better thing than an ASR33 teletype, fine. Create something to a typewriter. You could do it. That's the birth of our industry came from that concept. And so I said, well, then the garment has to have a bus. It has to have a channel where you can say all these little cords that go up and down. You know, you've got your iPod down here on your belt and the cord flying all over here like in the Apple billboards. Well, if you're in New York and that cord is flying all over the place and you're taking the subway, you know, you're going to lose your iPod. You know, it's a bad thing. You want to actually control all those cords and things. And at the same time, there are corded devices like you want a cell phone here and an iPod here, a little switch to go between them so you can change the audio. Really, a garment that doesn't have things built in, but allows you to put things into the garment and wire it the way you want it. And so I proceeded to look at designs. This is a trick you do with throwing fabric underneath and making a cutout and rotating it, and you come up with ideas for how it works. Then we went off to the garment district in New York. This is the statue of the sewing worker. Found this wild material. I said, well, I'm not going to use period material. I'm going to use 21st century material. This is holographic spandex that Galen found. I found this swatch isn't this nice seeing things that aren't computer screens? and you can touch and feel it. This is an embossed velvet, which was $200 a yard, but I found a hunk of it for $20. And then a lot of late nights in the bus. There's the bus late at night. Putting this darn thing together, it was just incredibly picky. I sewed through 30 yards of Velcro, because I wanted to fill it with Velcro intercept so I could tear off any component. And then I read on the back of the package says, do not machine sew. And there's coming together. And here it is, the piece there. So there's good old Harman there again. And there's my iPod with the channel, and there's the mesh on the top. And there's kind of multiple layers of stuff in this. So here you have, this is a layer, this whole panel is removable. And there's the iPod stuck in there. And down here, this is a women's fishnet stocking, the most indestructible material known to human beings. And that I wanted that really. I went into the store and bought like 8 pairs of fishnet stocking and they're giving me a nice big smile. I said, it's for an art, it's a garment project. And they said, yeah, right. So here's the back, and you'll notice I bought this so that in the light you got this incredible effect, this sort of holographic effect. You have to choose which way you cut materials. I learned all this stuff the hard way. And there is how it all came out.
Wow.
And I built a website called Cyberwares. And actually, I even brought it along.
Give me a model for you. Give you a little bit of it. So here's what it looks like. And the interesting thing was, look what happened to the form factor of the iPod. So initially this was built for the 20 gig iPod, and then they came out with this little clip thing, but it still works. And the idea was that this stuff is so beautifully designed that it's like jewelry, right? Why hide it? Why stick it in your pocket when you want to show it off? And I'm sure if YT had some cool like Sonic booster to knock down all the civil servants, she wanted very visible. That would be so cool. And so the idea was that, you know, the channels come around here and they go up the back. And this could be a solar collector in some future version of it. You can put your cell phone booster antenna up here. The wires go up through the neck, the little inside pockets there. And it worked pretty well. I'll sort of show you, I'll model this a bit. And it's still very much a prototype, so if something falls off of it, please forgive me.
You are too techie for your shirt.
That hasn't been said before. The idea was, and interestingly enough, if you read in the period of history when these are being worn, I mean, people's entire life savings were in their garments. It was their social status, it was everything. And of course, garments for us are sort of throwaway things, but the idea was that there's this peplum, and this is unique to this type of garment, and you can put all your gear in there, and you can have the cords going right through there and up the back, or through here, and wire them up here. I started making the second peplum I made had thinner pockets as I realized you were getting thinner devices, so there'd be thinner ones. And everything comes off, like this entire panel just comes right off. And the idea is that, you know, and this is the idea, was that the garment industry doesn't grok modern economics. Modern economics say you buy your base model, like your car or your iPod, and then you buy tons of accessories, and the accessories are where the money's made. But when you go and buy some high-end leather jackets, like, that's it. Costs you $500 and that's it. They're stupid. They're idiots. You should be able to buy the thing without the sleeves and then add the sleeves later. You should be able to buy jewelry with standard attach points and accessorize the garment every year, so there would be items that would come out of from a designer would attach onto it. You know, certainly all of this is your accessorization too. And look how this works. You can turn that on and you can run it right through this interface here. So that was the idea of really making it accessible. So that's the whole thing.
Wow.
It's not falling apart here.
Do you think the cords are becoming obsolete?
I don't know. I think cords will be always with us. So that's, let's sort of leave this on as we finish up.
Are you going to post these on the website? So we can...
They're on gamer.com.
Oh, they're done. Okay.
There's more.
Oh, okay.
There's more. So let's get the lights back down again, if we can.
We won't allow about half hour for Q&A, question. So we're at about 8:30 now.
We're at about 8:30, okay. Let me zoom through the rest of this. This is a lot of fun. So we can do, here's your starting your basic naked avatar. You can do garments in World now, and it's an incredible thing. So I went in and I found a kind soul who's, I think, sitting right here. You did this, right? Where you took the pictures of the cyber garment, and there it is on my avatar in London Lab.
That's the one.
That's the one. Green. I got green hair there. I prefer multicolored here, but I couldn't find it. So that's just a simple texture, so it doesn't have much of the detail. But there I am, sort of the combining of these two worlds. believe it or not, there's going to be technology coming out that you can print garments like an inkjet printer. Print right out of the source material and make garments. This is called whole garment knitting, and that's coming. So the thing you wear in the world could be actually made for your body. Next, I'll show you just a few views. This is our work. I formed a company called Digital Space in 1995, and from 2000, we've been doing a huge amount of simulation for NASA in their new exploration missions. So this is a bucket wheel excavator for the moon. This is a simulation of a lunar lander. Just to show you that coming through here. And the idea is that they want to move beyond just written documents and CAD files and actually put their designs into a real-time 3D physics-enabled world and see how well they work, even before they do their RFPs for industry. So this is becoming it's like the design simulation trying out the vehicle before you bid for it, you offer it for procurement. So this is a heavy lunar lander that, see what it does when it hits that rock. And this is all real time, so they can vary all the options. And we'll look at, this is a lightweight lander. Skip the movie. And here is a typical NASA way of designing a new mission. This is a mission to the south pole of the moon to look for water ice. So they start out with their typical PowerPoints. You go to a place called T-Max at JPL, where a bunch of people sit around in a room who are experts in propulsion or mass or budget or the launch system, whatever. And they come up with the numbers. And then a genius guy like this pulls together all the CAD. And then we recently, then you look where you're going to drive. This is a typical crater on the moon called Dawes Crater. You listen to experts like this guy, his name is Red Whitaker. He's a roboticist. And then we do a real-time drivable vehicle that by a couple of days from now, they have their design. And it actually drives in virtual craters. This is going to drive down some slopes. And then they can actually start thinking, gee, when we're driving down that steep of a slope, we're going to have the sun right on our backs. It's going to heat the vehicle up and more. And the vehicle's going to even be dustier than it is on the flats. And our radiators aren't going to work, and we're going to burn up. And so all these things happen when you do the simulation, rather than just waving your hands and doing some sketches. So this is driving down a slope, and there's another rocky slope that we're going to drive down. So this is what they would spend millions of dollars doing by bending metal and building a moon yard, a moon hazard yard. So that gives you an idea. And kids are using some of our environments in schools, which is really cool. It's paid for by you, the taxpayer. I'll just flip through this. This is another study we did of showing how to build a moon base completely without people by telerobotics, all delivered to the moon in this large flying rack. That's another typical design study we'll do. Mining industry, underground mining, we're doing a bunch of things. When you have physics, it's very good. You have all kinds of interesting applications. So this is a jumbo drill in an underground mine. And like everybody else, we built a plug-in base. This is all open source. We built this from 2004 onwards, open source components. It's all available at digitalspaces.net if you want it. Last little topic here is something that you can see that's happening at the edges, at the very crazy, wild edges of this medium. And that is this concept that somehow life and cyberspace are connected. And you might see this in examples of the emergent little simple A-life experiments inside your virtual worlds. And there's some kind of an inkling, there's something there. Here's stromatolites, the things that gave us breathable oxygen. Here's a living colony of them in Australia. There's only a couple of those left. And how life transformed the atmosphere. Now we're transforming the atmosphere again. And how it's very, very hard to go to space because we're living in these 19th century pressure vessels that have single points of failure. And we need living ships. And so I started a group called Biota, and the first conference we did was up here at 8,000 feet in the Canadian Rockies at the Burgess Shale, where we got to crack open rocks and look at Cambrian creatures from 535 million years ago, when nature was doing all the explosive experiment with bodies and coming up with all these odd creatures. These are some of the people at the event and some of the simulations that were shown. And we went on and did a growing L-system garden at a cigarette conference. And then we were all inspired very much by Carl Sims' work on the evolving blocky creatures that you guys may have seen.
But these creatures are the result of...
Anybody seen this? This was about 15 years ago, but basically Carl Sims took a connection machine with many tens of thousands of processors and built a virtual world where he had hinged blocks. And through a process called artificial... Alan all were talking. A process called artificial evolution, he was able to iterate generation after generation of these blocks with hands-off. Little graphs would develop in their genotype, and you would get these behaviors emerging, like a really good swimmer or a really good walker. And these creatures competed for food, and he would run these things for weeks, and then he would look at these really complicated behaviors and strategies for dealing with the environment that all emerged, and he would look into the code, and it was a big mess. He didn't understand the code. But Carl's blocky creature sort of has inspired generations of people thinking in this way. So that's the first creature. And all it did was do this hinged movement. It couldn't move through the water very effectively, but after hundreds or thousands of millions of generations in the connection machine, they got better and better and better. This is all from about 1991-92. And it's all very simple algorithms that he's published. So if you want to do something very cool in your platform, do Carl Sims' experiment. So this was a sort of great inspiring behind the biota.org organization. And you'll see that at biota.org, we have a podcast series about this, and we've had four conferences on this. So let's just move on quickly, because I know we're short on time. But there's the connection machine that in which this artificial evolution occurred, and now these are all just fossils. Let's get past that. So in a sense, your virtual worlds platform may be a platform also for evolution to try some experiments. And if you marry artificial evolution, and in the future, in 50 years from now, the virtual world platform could evolve a creature that could live on an asteroid and eat the asteroid and provide us gases and water consumables, that you could populate the solar system with life forms that were initially evolved in a hyper way inside cyberspace. And I think that that's kind of the great, you know, very abstract maybe sounding, but the way to get life off the Earth is to actually evolve life that's appropriate to live off the Earth. And the way to do that is to do it inside virtual worlds. So let's come back to the end, or it's actually back to the beginning, and I thought this would lighten you up at the end of the talk and provide you an insight that this has kind of been a vision for cyberspace. Virtual worlds have been a vision for cyberspace for a long time. This is from a cartoon book drawn by Rich Daday, and I don't know if he's still alive, in the summer of 1976. And if you look at this thing, you'll go, gee, they were thinking way ahead, because in 1976 there was no Apple II. There were only homebrew computer kits and, of course, big mainframes. So if you wanted a computer, you ordered one, or you got one from your local bike shop. And so Arnold here, the teenager, noticed the bell-bottom pants. He's gotten his homebrew kit, finally showed up in the mail. So he takes it into his room and locks the family out. So this is a proto-nerd. And, of course, he solders the thing together. Before you got your computer, for a good price, puts it all together, and he's ready. He's dragging his user interface over. Now he can code. And if you've seen that expression, some of your companies, and this is where it comes from. Now he's got this vision for code. And this is possessed. Arnold drove himself staying at the keyboard day and night, not stopping to eat or sleep. But what's he making? At last, his alternate reality was completed. There he goes, from his little Altair 8080 into the virtual world. And with his dream girl, of course. who probably puts up with it. So off they go, flying off just like they would in Vare or Linden or Active Worlds or whatever. So we've almost come to the ends of our story. Which do you choose to believe? Is he dead on the ground, you know, or is he actually gone into that space? And the motto was, or the warning was, personal computer, or microcomputer, homebrew computer, whatever it was called then, it's just another tool. Use it. Don't let it use you. And did we listen? And so now, questions. And I'll just, there's kind of some of my hand-waving points. What is this medium going? Is it to make a buck or to create a new world? Or is, should it be open source, distributed versus centralized? Is it artistic expression? Is it all a boondoggle? Is it sucking up all of human imagination and brains? Or is it liberating us? What are your thoughts? Are you there? You heard it? Great. Okay.
So we'll go to some Q&A now. That was a really amazing presentation. Just call some questions, or we'll also have some questions from the folks joining us in Second Life, so hopefully we can get to some Q&A in about the next half hour.
If you want these slides, ask me, and they're on the web already. The PowerPoint is 73 megabytes. Without the movies. Questions from... Yeah, over
here. You mentioned you will get some help from a university in Sweden on some of this stuff, the timeline. And I was wondering, I have this impression that there's a lot that's been happening also in Asia, particularly in Korea. Are you able to capture that? Will that go into the timeline? Or do you have to market this project in that part of the world to get that
in? I've got a huge Rolodex of probably out-of-date email addresses, but usually, like the Korean university professors don't move. You know how it gets stuck there. So I will rely on the grapevine, but it's going to be a site that anyone can contribute to. And you'd literally choose your point on the timeline and say, I choose a date for it and fill in a very minimal thing or a detailed thing and then upload it. But then we need a whole layer of people who really know the subject who can go in and it'll be held in a conveyance mechanism until someone approves it in, like Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. Or Wikipedia publishes, then they withdraw. But we need experts, and Randy Farmer's already said, oh, of course I'll do anything to do with X, Y, and, which is great. You know, we couldn't have a better expert. So we need expert layer to validate and vet the material and to cross-link it. What is it connected to? Question in the front here?
Sure. So a lot of what you showed of the evolution of avatars was their differentiation or of their physical appearance. I wonder if you've done anything analogous with people's behavior as avatars over time. Have they got more complex interactive behavior? Are there more social norms developing with regards to avatars?
I think if you go into Traveler, where you're talking, you're navigating to talk and you're embodied in the head, your behavior is so different than when you're in Second Life or there, where you're looking often. Also, it depends on the world, like Worlds Away was, where you want to see yourself from outside all the time. You're not embodied in first person. I could imagine this would be a number of doctoral dissertations could be done on this subject alone. But I think it depends on the affordances. And Traveler, I haven't seen, it's kind of at an end of evolutionary nub, and I'm waiting to see if somebody will do another thing like that. But I think the sort of the overhead view or behind view, moving where you can see yourself dance and whatnot, is a pretty locked-in format. And maybe people are unduly restricted by that, I don't know. Maybe with Wii and things, when you can gesture and move yourself like this. Galen's always talking about, you know, we had a great sort of a spiritual healer woman at Avatars 96 who came and she said, I'm going to shake you people up, because she looked out at this audience of mirrors and said, you people don't move.
you sit in front of the screens looking at moving virtual bodies, but you're sitting there and you're not moving your own bodies. And she was worried about them becoming like Spock's brain or that pilot for Star Trek, where the guys are like this. And so she had everybody get up and move and whatnot and said, you know, don't you make your body die just because you're embodying yourself this way. So, you know, perhaps when we are gesturing and moving, we're going to be different. So, question in the back.
So I've been thinking that, so people have been doing intentional communities for centuries, but online worlds makes it really easy to set up kind of experiments in different social dynamics, rules, and so forth. And I'm wondering, what are some of the most interesting experiments you've seen of that nature in online worlds?
Well, I think one of the greatest ones was this kid in Alabama. I can tell you the story. He wanted to build a floating city called Sky City in one of the platforms. And he built, got all these kids from all over the world together, different languages and cultures and whatnot, and they started putting this thing together. And initially it was a hodgepodge, and they tore it all apart, and then they actually drew it on graph paper, and then they rebuilt it all. And they all had common permissions to build. And it wasn't done as a school project at all. It was just, he had this passion for it. And he learned enough, say, Hebrew to say a few things in sort of anglicized Hebrew, and enough French. And so they kind of got along pretty well, and it grew and grew. And then at one point, they were standing in their little talking circle, and there were two kids that really had totally disagreed with building something very structured and whatnot, and just nobody got along with them, and they formed a little cabal. And then they, one night, when nobody was around in Sky City, they came and tore it apart, because they all had common permission to build, they had common permission to destroy. And Brian said, it was terrible. We came and we saw bits and pieces of our city that they had left. It was like a total earthquake had hit it or something that was destroyed. And they were shattered. But they still had their meeting in their shattered talking circle area. The two kids that came back stood at the edge. And you can see all the primate social dynamics happening here. Stood at the edge, not in a circle, and they all talked about the destruction of the city and what they felt. And then all those two kids that said, well, you know, don't you build it and you trash it. I mean, that's the way you do it. You know, that's the way you do it in a game, in games. You build, you destroy, you build. Because they were in that, for that mentality, why would you build something to make it something perfect? And they apologized. Those two kids said, we really sorry to hurt your feelings. And they left and they went back to Quaker, wherever it was they really wanted to do. And the guys rebuilt the entire city. And later on, what was interesting was he became a 6'8" guy. And he was in high school, this is 4 or 5 years later, and he was in charge of the school play, like building all the props and stuff for this giant play. And it was very reminiscent of when he was doing Sky City when he was like 12. And he came to his father one day and said, I can't do my history report and this at once. Something's going to have to give. You know, I will probably get a C in history if I don't fill it in. And his father said, well, you should do the history report. But it's your decision. And so he went to the school and made the decision and built all the props, stayed up all night, worked with his team of students, just like in Sky City. He had forgotten about Sky City. And they had the play came off great, and his father asked him, well, what was the basis for your decision? Well, if I didn't do the report, I would have disappointed two people, you and the teacher. If I didn't do these props, I would disappoint a lot more people. And he said, that was a wise decision. So in a sense, that for me, the story of Brian and Sky City was like, that is the meeting at its best as a tool for learning. He learned about project, and I talked to him about this, a couple of years ago, which is now in the world doing all these projects, and he said, well, I guess I learned about cross the cultures of people. I learned about how to motivate a group of people, how to budget our time, how to figure out when we're finished, or when we screwed up and have to redo it, and then how to promote Sky City so someone visits it so people feel like, well, it's something, and then how to solve the problem when there's conflict, really bad conflict, city's destroyed. So he learned, and I told him, you learn everything we need to live in the 21st century in this environment. So that to me was, you know, that was in 96, 97, I think. And he's, you know, off some big international career, I would guess, by now. But boy, what a great training ground. And he would bring that to the school and show the teachers, and they couldn't believe what they were seeing, that kind of learning about. So, other questions? I know there were a lot of
Some of the people from inside Second Life here were asking about open source. It's on your list too. So what are your thoughts about open source? Which would open source be required for a kind of huge adopted virtual world? Well, what are your thoughts on open source?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I, for the last 6 years, have led a company of a dozen employees to build, with open source components, what you saw that does for NASA. It's not a community platform. It doesn't have avatars in it and whatnot. I can tell you, this stuff is so hard, requires so much investment of time and work. It is so much different than putting up a web server and simple technologies like that. That the requirement, I think, for making, you have to have a whole bunch of things for a big open source platform to take off. And one of them is have a readily available market that's going to uptake it and drive its development. Unfortunately, in virtual worlds, we've got stovepipe after stovepipe, maybe as many as 500 scene graph / game engine. There's got to be at least 500 of these things in development or that have been thrown on the draft sheet. Hundreds of them. And everybody wants to do their own. And there's only a limited amount of time that someone has in their energy to make a platform like this. And then to promulgate it when the market's so tiny and so fragmented all over the place, it's really tough. It was certainly easy to make make Hotmail. We made it, it was free, it spread itself. Everybody wanted email. How many people are just hankering at the bit for a virtual world space? So you find out, one of the things that one of the Lindens asked me at the Second Life user convention, she said, when is this going global, mainstream, millions of people will use it? I'll say, okay, I can answer that with a question. For you to become who you are in the environment, in the world, how many hours did it take you to go in there, establish a name for yourself, navigate around, make your connections, get swag, make a space, and she says, well, it was about a year of time. And how much time per day, and like, at least, you know, I'd have to be in there like 10, 15 hours a week to get to where I am now. I said, well, there you are. That's the self-limiting factor of this medium in a rich social virtual world. So much time commitment. And as people get, I think you would find that there's sort of the balloons of age. You have the gamer age, you know, in the teens through the 20s, and then people get kids and mortgages, and their time is sliced up. You have to understand that demographic, and then people somehow get freed up again, and then maybe they have more time, and it's just a huge commitment to do this. And I found, and this is sort of a last point, we are not immune to the effects of VR, that nauseating effect of the vestibular system. I found that after doing this for 15 years nonstop, and then we started working with NASA, and I was saying like, oh, you know, I get totally disoriented. I've been in this world for 15 hours building or whatever, and I come out and I'm disoriented to the point where I'm walking down the street and I'm saying, oh, this piece of sidewalk, pick it up and move it, make a copy, and move this tree over. I just think I can manipulate the whole world that way. And it's dangerous when you're on a farm where you're raising pigs. The pig does not want to move. It's not going to get coffee that easily. So I was talking about sort of this vertigo effect that I get, this imbalance effect, and this great tiredness in the head. And they said, oh, that's MMU syndrome. That's when the guys go out on the jetpack and the shuttle, or they're out on their feet are connected to the space station arm, and they're pulling stuff off and they're doing stuff. It says they don't get physically tired, they get emotionally exhausted after several hours and get these stand down periods because they're trying to think in 3D all the time. It's like, that's over there, and that tool's attached to that. And if I push there, I'll float back here, and my colleague's there, and I have 5 chat messages going. I'm talking to the ground, I'm talking to the shuttle, I'm talking to the station. They get cognitively overloaded, and they get brain tired. Their bodies are still able to work. Then they have blackouts. On the Mir, one of the reasons that Mir had the big collision was that commander was so mentally exhausted, cognitively overloaded, that he blacked out. He was sitting there, and he went black. And then 3 seconds later, he went back, and he watched the monitor, and the progress was going right past, and was going to collide with the spectrum object. He was exhausted. And in our environment, we're not immune from this. And I can tell you that after I took like a year or two break from avatar space, and then I jumped into the Vera Beta and then the Linden Beta, and initially it was like, Jesus, I don't want to be here anymore. I am so tired. My brain is remembering the hours and hours. And it isn't like instant messages that are short and sweet coming in. It's like, oh, I have to engage all these neurons to navigate into this and that, and I don't want to go back there. And I don't know if I'm just one data point, but I think you may have a sort of a wearing out of the user base that just cannot stomach it anymore. And that's a little bit of a, it's a challenge for our medium in here. It's maybe a little bit too much for the finite brain in the way it is right now. So you had a question?
I was just going to say, it just popped my head up, the time that it takes. Maybe this is why my space is really proliferating. Right now I keep watching it and seeing the evolution of my space just continue to roll in. And it's kind of amazing looking back on where we started with the virtual.
There was a great Machinima movie. Is it called Machinima? Machinima. The most funny one at the second one convention was like, gee, I'd like to pop in and say hello to somebody, for just a second. So they start the second by client and it downloads 33 freaking megabytes of update and then they go on this and that and this and accept that and blah, blah, and 3 minutes have gone by and they go and they jump in and they try to use the interface and find the person and say hi. And versus, so that's a real problem for adoption.
I had another question, which seems to be one of the other kind of big debates right now, which is, based on your experience and the difficulties, but also the exciting stuff that you talked about, do you think that 3D space is something that everyone is absolutely going to have on their desktop in the next few years?
No. Absolutely not.
So some people can live without it.
It is self-selecting. Because, you really have to become students of perceptual psychology and understanding, there are people who walk through the world and know exactly where they are. Like, oh, I turned left out of the movie theater. And their spouse, they're like, I'm lost. They're immersed in the film and I have no idea where the car is. So the idea of navigating in a space and having to remember where you were and what level you were on, there are people with a strong acuity for that, and there are people who don't have that. And then, of course, you also have the fact that everything's going to packages no bigger than this in computing. And, with the iPhone, even though you can scroll around, how much of a 3D experience, immersive experience, are you going to get on that iPhone screen? And you can guarantee I'm not going to haul this 14-pound monster around. As soon as the iPhone can do everything, Keynote and maybe some 3D, that's going. That's just a boat anchor. And so in a sense, you're fighting that. But on the other hand, you're going to have incredible plasma displays. For the people who are into that experience, it'll be richer and more beautiful than ever. But I think it's a limited population. Just as bloggers and people who like to read lots of text, that we think that that's everybody. It's not. There's people who will post, and they're like a tiny percentage, and then there's people who actually read all that stuff. It's actually a really small selection of the population. Most people want to be fed video. I think there's probably more people watch YouTube for entertainment than read blogs by now, even if YouTube's only a year or two old. It's gone to your gear. Yeah, and I frankly, I feel that I had an incredible privilege, two privileges in technology in my life. One was that I got to build some of the first icons on a computer screen for PCs, not the Mac project, but working with Xerox. And I got to, make the technology to make a pull-down menu work and disappear. And that was, whoa, because people hadn't seen a mouse. They hadn't seen that you could paint and draw on a PC. The Mac had just come out, but Xerox had had that for years. And I did all that, and boy, that was hard. Every pixel you had to paint, but everything you had to control. And then to be in the beginning of the virtual world meeting where it's this green plane and there's people standing around saying, what are we doing? It was very, very fresh. When I go into a lot of the worlds now, it's like going into a MySpace environment. It's so cluttered with crap. And there's so many gestures. People are moving so quickly. And it's become very busy, like a commercial shopping mall or billboards, and you're overwhelming people. So just allowing that to happen, you create the mess that our urban environment is with walls and just the clutter. And then people, they get overloaded and they don't see things anymore. And I think that that's a danger that we have.
And we've already layered a virtual world on top of our natural physical world. Anyone who has a cell phone, Google, Yelp, and Twitter is now experiencing a second layer of virtual
content mess
on top of your normal content. I go to a cafe, I want to know if it's any good, but now I don't know how. Oh, well, I'll go to Yelp on my phone. Ah, okay, 9 out of 10 people say the coffee sucks. Go across the street. Mm-hmm. And it's happened. Like, I'm accessing information.
It's smart
nowhere in my real world. Yeah. It's already layered physically and easy way to collect the data.
Here's something to think about. It's an amazing vision of the future. We don't have moon colonies or people living in space, but we have this. But there's interesting research going on. There's a professor, Antonino Damasio. I don't know if anybody's read the books. But what he's found, and he's like a canary in the mine. And I can see this happening to me. I was living in Silicon Valley, in these worlds, and I said, I am going to go freaking nuts if all I'm doing is in-world and online. And I bought a farm with pigs. So I have to go out in the morning, they get fed. They don't get eaten. They eat us. Got to prune fruit trees, got to dig culverts out, put in gardens, wheat, all that stuff. Because I knew if I didn't have that, I would be imploded because of my personality and all this stuff. And I like the stimulus of the world. And it kind of counterbalances, like I can't just simply move that tree over and, you know, move the pig over. And I started reading books about this, because I knew I had to have that rebalance, otherwise I was going to go freaking crazy. And I was thinking, what about the people who don't have the luxury of having this farm they have to do this with? You know, get up, this morning I'm up at 7 o'clock in the morning because I call this number and it says, today is a burn day. It's a burn day, and I can burn this mountain 30 feet high of material I've been having to burn all winter. So go out and burn that. Now, if I was too wired and online, I might make a mistake and burn myself up by mistake because I would think I could, you know, do stuff. So I started reading. I said, what about the people who are in this wired existence, getting more and more wired? How's it going to affect humanity? And I read this book by Damasio, and he talked about the two-speed brain. He's a clinician. Two-speed brain. Clinically, they can show that in order for you to have an emotional memory of something, or like something happened in childhood, recover that memory takes a long time, actually. It takes a lot of suggestion and a lot of quiet, and then the memory starts coming. It actually takes a long time to make emotional memories and deep memories. It's a slower process. Then there's the wired part of the brain that runs on milliseconds. Answer the cell phone. Instant decision. Blink. You know, instant. As more and more people live in the second speed brain, the higher gear, than live in the lower gear, they're becoming what the clinical psychologists call emotionally neutral. And that's a very sort of a kind term for saying that people who are completely wired and have no feelings at all and can't access the feelings, so they drive home and their kids are screaming and their spouse is screaming at them and they're like, I can't even absorb it. I'm walking through it and it's not, they can't connect with that. And an interesting parallel, while I was getting to know Damasio's work, Galen and I have this friend who runs a called East-West Tri-State Acupuncture Practice in New York City. He was the first person to bring acupuncture to the Western audience rather than treating organs, it would be treating emotional conditions. You know, that's our version of Chinese acupuncture. And he's had his practice for 25 years, wrote all the original books. And then one day, in walks the Hasidic Rebbe. And these Rebbes, or Rebbe, they're big bearded guys with the traditional hats, a little different hat for each little community in Brooklyn. And he's like, what's a Rebbe doing here? It's not a rabbi. The Rebbe's like the father figure of the whole community, whether you're related to him or not. And he said, I've got a problem. It's with my community. You know, and Hasidim, the Hasidic rabbis and Hasidim are very high tech. They're Jews that they're not like the people that in the horse and buggy. They run H&R Electronics in Manhattan and everything. They're pagers and cell phones, and so they're that way. And he said, my people, I can't reach them. They can't reach each other. They're not talking anymore. They're not connecting anymore. I got to do something about this. Someone had sent it to him. And our friend said, fine, start sending them in. We'll see what we can do. And it turns out that acupuncture, in a way, you know, you could take drugs, you could do yoga for 15 years, and or acupuncture, which reboots you. I mean, when you hit these points, and I've done this kind of treatment, you start crying and whatever, it's somehow rebooting you, and it's rebooting your brain and letting it clean up crap or whatever. And after one of these sessions, you feel so wonderfully balanced and level, and you can smell flowers again and all that. It gradually goes away as the cell phone starts ringing.
I don't mean to interrupt you. It's really great you brought us full circle. It's 9 o'clock, though, and they're going to be kicking us out real soon.
And the end of the story is, indeed, these people were helped. But it took someone who knew them since birth, over 50 years, to tell them there's something going on here. We don't have that luxury of someone watching over us. So with that, that's the end of the talk. And if you want a book, I'm happy to sign them. I do have a few posters from the Avatars Conference. I want to thank the SD Forum and Bob and everybody for coming out and spending so much time.
Once again, we're going to be back here 1 month from now with Forterra Systems. You guys, please come back. I want to thank everybody who came out. Please give us some feedback, what you like, what you didn't like. I want to thank those who attended in Second Life. Thanks for showing up here at SD Forum. Innovation Island. This is your host, Mr. O. We're going to turn you back over to the stream. Thanks for showing up. Next month, same time, same channel for Terra Systems.
My wife, she makes me an apple juice like that. Much better than I am.
Yeah, this is hard. Watching me work with fabric is like what?
And maybe